Good evening, everyone, and hello. You're listening to Revision Media at revisionmedia.org. Today is Wednesday, November 6th, 2019. I'm your host, Richard Carey, and this is Arcane Semantics. I do have a guest who's going to be joining us in hour number two. A good friend of mine I've known for a while, Mr. John Friend. Now, John is an independent researcher, blogger, journalist, and he maintains TheRealistReport.com, examining the agendas of the New World Order, of the global power elite. But John focuses primarily on the events of 9/11, World War II, revisionism, media deception, and psychological warfare, power and influence of the Zionist lobby in America, and the systematic assault upon and subversion of traditional Western European civilization. But John's going to join us tonight to discuss hate speech laws, anti-Semitism, and censorship, among related topics. Callers are welcome to call in if you would like to speak to John, you have a question, or would like to hear his take on a given matter. For that matter, phone lines are open now in the remaining first hour. If someone would like to join in the chat, in the discussion here, always like to hear from our listenership firsthand with feedback. Allow you to have a platform as well. All our voices should be heard, even if we disagree amongst one another at times. Somewhat might be right in one issue, that person might be very wrong on another. But all our input is valid. We're trying to rebuild what was once Western culture. This idea war is an ongoing challenge in life. Really, it's something that I say always has been there and always will. It's the task of those of us who can find the time to maintain, preserve, pass on this knowledge, this information, which is suppressed to so much of the population. I was noticing a recent article John put out on his website, TheRealistReport.com, but it got quite a bit of additional circulation. This was from September 7th, 2019. John Friend, article entitled, Former ADL Staffer Appointed Head of Orwellian Office for the Prevention of Hate Crimes in New York City. And this was actually circulated in quite a few other locations. I noticed nationalvanguard.org, the organization founded by and preserving the teachings of Dr. William Luther Pierce. nationalvanguard.org, very reputable. Yeah, they just had John's article up, in addition to americannationalsocialist.com. That website as well evidently also reposted John's article here from September. I was very pleased to see one of our fellow journalists who's pro-white actually getting so much republishing so much exposure in the current era. That just shows the demand and the desire by readers for something that doesn't have the same corporate media / Hollywood anti-white narrative and agenda, and the same Jewish perception, politically speaking, on censorship and hate crime issues, so-called hate speech. But let me go on to get into a bit of this. Actually, I think it's a good, obviously a lot of people agree to republish. In yet another display of Jewish privilege, New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio recently announced that a former ADL staffer and professional Jewish ethnic activist named Deborah Lauter will be the first head of the newly created Office for the Prevention of Hate Crimes, a specially created office to combat quote-unquote anti-Semitism and quote-unquote hate. Two weaponized concepts designed to prevent any sort of honest criticism or discussion of Jewish power and influence and the ongoing agenda to systematically enforce white genocide in America and the wider Western world. The office will, quote, coordinate with 10 agencies, from police to mental health programs, that are tasked in some way with addressing hate, unquote, according to the Jewish Telegraph Agency, and will have a budget of $1.7 million for the first year in operation. After that, the office will receive $700,000 annually to combat, quote-unquote, hate in New York City. Professional Jewish ethnic activists and Jewish groups praised Mayor de Blasio's announcement, which they have been lobbying for in the wake of rising, quote-unquote, anti-Semitism and attacks on Orthodox Jews in various parts of New York City, attacks that have largely been carried out by blacks, as Colin Flaherty has documented. And then we have a report from the Allgemeiner. Recently reported, Jewish leaders welcome new hate crimes prevention office in New York, led by ex-ADL staffer Deborah Lauter. For those who aren't aware, ADL is Anti-Defamation League, a Jewish organization, which is certainly far and beyond what its original calling was for. Actually, though, it was founded over a case defending a Jew who was convicted of sexual abuse. But, I mean, he was one of their people. He was of the tribe. And they had to get him out. It was actually after he was lynched. The court, him having tribal connections, let him off on a life sentence rather than to be charged with a death sentence. And he was lynched by the town people. The townspeople yanked him out of prison and, yep, a little local justice there. But the ADL was founded on this treatment of a fellow Jew, regardless of what he did. You know, hey, he won in court. That's all that mattered, right? So, anyway. Jewish leaders and advocacy organizations have warmly welcomed the opening of a new office in New York City to combat the rising tide of anti-Semitic and racist hate crimes. Quote, we welcome the creation of the New York City Office for the Prevention of Hate Crimes, and we hope it will stem the tide of increased acts against Jews and others, unquote, Arthur Stark, Chairman, and Malcolm Holling, Executive Vice Chairman and CEO of the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations, said in a statement on Wednesday, quote, "The sharp increase in bias incidents in recent years, particularly of anti-Semitic crimes, requires a coordinated approach to maximize the resources available from all facets of law enforcement, to prosecutors, to the educational system, to the voluntary sector." New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio announced the hire of the executive director of the new office, Deborah Lauter, on Tuesday, a Jewish organizational veteran who spent the last 18 years with the Anti-Defamation League, ADL. Lauter's appointment won plaudits from Jewish commentators and leaders on social media. The United States federal government already has an, quote, anti-Semitism, unquote, envoy within the United States Department. It is specifically dedicated to protecting Jewish people in America and around the world. Could it be any more obvious how much power and influence the organized Jewish community wields in America? Or the special treatment and privilege Jews receive at all levels of American society? So, I thought that was a pretty good concise report there. We have another one, October 23rd, 2019, from Mr. Friend, "The Media's Love Affair with Hate Crimes." Too often the media is duped by hate crime hoaxers, yet never correct the record. Here are two more recent examples. Yet another highly publicized quote-unquote hate crime has turned out to be a total fabrication after the purported victim and her family publicly admitted the entire incident was made up. The alleged hate crime made national headlines and went viral after the purported victim, a 12-year-old black girl in Springfield, Virginia, gave numerous interviews to various media outlets late last month. The sixth grade student at Emmanuel Christian School, a private institution in Fairfax, Virginia, originally told her grandparents, school officials, and the media that a group of three young white students pinned her down and tried cutting off her dreadlocks. She alleged the young white students called her ugly and her hair nappy, and held her hands down and covered her mouth while they attempted to cut her hair with scissors. "They kept laughing and calling me names," she told CBS affiliate WUSA-TV in an interview following the alleged attack. Quote, "They called me ugly, said I shouldn't have been born. They called me an attention seeker," unquote. You think? The girl's mother called for the alleged suspects to be kicked out of the school for their apparent racially motivated attack. The problem is, the charge turned out to be a complete fabrication. The initial reporting of the alleged quote-unquote hate crime sparked national outrage and a police investigation. On September 30th, school officials and the girl's family confirmed the alleged quote-unquote hate crime attack had been fabricated by the young student. "We can now confirm that the student who accused three of her classmates of assault has acknowledged that the allegations were false," Stephen Danish, the school's principal, said in a statement sent to parents, community members, and the media. Quote, "We're grateful to the Fairfax County Police Department for their diligent work to investigate these allegations. While we are relieved to hear the truth to bring the events of the past few days to a close, We also feel tremendous pain for the victims and the hurt on both sides of this conflict, unquote. The girl's grandparents, who are her legal guardians, also released a public statement apologizing for the false allegations and the tremendous pain and suffering caused by the latest fake, quote-unquote, hate crime in America. Those two young boys and their parents We sincerely apologize for the pain and anxiety these allegations have caused, the grandparents wrote. To the administrators and families of Emmanuel Christian School, we are sorry for the damages this incident has done to trust within the school family and the undue scorn it has brought to the school. To the broader community, who rallied in such passionate support for their daughter, we apologize for betraying your trust. They went on to indicate they, quote, understand there will be consequences, unquote, for the false accusations, and they are, quote, prepared to take responsibility for them, unquote. They are to be commended for their honesty and their willingness to take responsibility for their granddaughter's actions, which were, after all, those of a 12-year-old child. She can be forgiven, but the mainstream news media cannot. They refuse to take responsibility for jumping the gun and not checking the facts before reporting such stories. Worse, when their fake news is exposed, they simply ignore their unprofessional behavior and rarely, if ever, admit they have been had. This kind of slipshod reporting can be very dangerous, as it can falsely inflame the passions of viewers. Another fake hate crime. In related news, a former NFL football player was also recently accused of staging a fake, quote-unquote, hate crime after it was discovered he had attempted to destroy and vandalize his business in an effort to portray himself as the victim of a racially motivated robbery. Adon Lewis Kaufman, 31, was arrested by police officers in Georgia on charges related to insurance fraud and filing a false report of the crime. An Atlanta Journal-Constitution reported. Police were dispatched to Crete and Bake Restaurant and Kaufman's Creamery about 9:30 p.m. on September 25th, following a report of a burglary at the business owned by Kaufman. Police searched the area and eventually pulled over Kaufman, who was driving nearby. They then went to the restaurant, where they discovered damage and vandalism at the property. Officers saw racially motivated words, swastikas, and MAGA. Ooh, a police spokesperson said. Several booth cushions were sliced open. They also found broken mirrors, cut wires, and a damaged video surveillance system. The smell of spray paint was very fresh. When officers touched it, the paint appeared wet. Kaufman explained to officers that he reported the damage to his insurance company earlier in the day, but did not call police. Police eventually searched Kaufman's truck and found black spray paint and a crowbar, which were used to break in and vandalize his own business in order to commit insurance fraud. They also found television screens that had been ripped from the walls of the restaurant. It appears as though Adon conjured and premeditated this plan to damage his own property, attempt to make it appear as a hate crime, file a claim with his insurance company, and sell off the undamaged appliances and electronics, the police spokesperson said following the incident. Kaufman has not admitted to staging the incident and apologized. However, he and his attorney have maintained his innocence, and he awaits a further trial date. And this article was originally published by American Free Press on October 23rd, 2019. Of course, this is a publication as well that John Friend writes for, so he put it on his own website as well. But it is a couple of great examples of just how the media has an agenda when it comes to these hate crimes and how they can use them in attempts to legislate changes to our laws, including threats to our First Amendment. This is as important as anything out there. Here's another article here. Free speech is fundamentally, quote-unquote, anti-Semitic. Pretty interesting title, for that matter. September 29th, 2019. Malaysian Prime Minister Mahathir Mohamad may be the most important political figure in the entire world. He is certainly the most courageous, righteous, and honest statesman that I've ever encountered. He is clearly not afraid to speak the truth about organized Jewry, their power and influence in the world, and their weaponized buzzwords used to stifle any criticism or honest discussion of their criminality and nation-wrecking agendas, which we have documented in previous blog posts here. The Honorable Malaysian Prime Minister recently addressed the Global Leaders Forum at Columbia University, which truly enraged the Jews. The organized Jewish community had been hoping that Columbia University would cancel his scheduled appearance at the prestigious forum, and continued to condemn his presence when Columbia commendably refused to back down. Well, good for Columbia there. Ronald Lauder, the president of the World Jewish Congress, sent a letter to Columbia University stating he would encourage his friends to, quote, immediately cease any of their contributions to your institution until such a time anti-Semitic despots are no longer welcome on your campus. We have here a tweet of Jonathan Greenblatt that is highlighted in the midst of the article. Jonathan Greenblatt tweets, "For decades, Mahathir Mohamad has blamed Jews for Malaysia's and the world's ills. Recently at Oxford and Cambridge universities, among almost 200 heads of state in New York this week, it's a shame that Columbia community chose to feature him on their stage." Jonathan Greenblatt tweets there. That was September 24th. His speech had nothing to do with organized Jewry. His views on the alleged Holocaust, that's in quotes, quote-unquote Holocaust, during World War II, or quote-unquote anti-Semitism, but of course an obnoxious Jewish student asked him a question about his views on these topics. His response was epic. They actually, if you go to the article, you'll be able to check out a little video John has there if you want to hear the gentleman's response. "How do you not love this guy?" the Algminer reports. "If you can't be anti-Semitic, there's no free speech," Malaysian PM Mahathir Mohamad tells appreciative crowd at Columbia University. It's good that he had an appreciative crowd, I must say. Malaysian Prime Minister Mahathir Mohamad defended his right to express anti-Semitic views in the name of free speech. In remarks to Columbia University students on Wednesday, speaking to a packed audience at the university's Global Leaders Forum, the 94-year-old leader, mind you, whose decades-old conviction that, quote, the Jews rule the world by proxy, unquote, has never wavered, also refused to say whether he accepted the fact that 6 million Jews were murdered during the Nazi Holocaust. There was no National Socialist Holocaust, folks. That's my interjection there, but you can check with John. I don't think he'd have much of a different response. The article goes on. Why can't I say something about the Jews when people say nasty things about me and about Malaysia? Mahathir complained as he responded to a powerfully worded challenge posed by a member of the Columbia chapter of Students Supporting Israel. The Malaysian leader went on to argue, when you say you cannot be anti-Semitic, there is no free speech. Indeed, if one cannot openly criticize Jews, question and dispute the official quote-unquote Holocaust narrative of World War II, engage in serious scholarly research into the background and ideology of Adolf Hitler and National Socialist Germany, or make quote-unquote anti-Semitic and quote-unquote hateful statements about Jews and other minorities, then there's no free speech. As the Prime Minister powerfully and correctly stated, anyone with the ability to think critically should be able to engage in serious scholarly research into any topic of interest to them. The very concept of free speech, certainly from the American perspective, revolves around specifically protecting individuals expressing controversial and dissenting political, historical, social, or racial perspectives, ensuring they are allowed to express their point of view without violence being inflicted upon them or without the government interfering or harming their ability to do so. How telling it is to be reminded of this basic bedrock principle of American political traditions by the Prime Minister of an Asian country. The only American politician I'm aware of speaking out on this issue is Tulsi Gabbard, who has commendably addressed the issue of free speech and the tech tyranny we see unfolding in America. And as the article closes, it also depicts a tweet from Tulsi Gabbard from September 29th. Tulsi tweets, "We need to stand up and protect everyone's right to the freedom of speech, the First Amendment. I may not agree with what you say, but I will put my life on the line to protect your right to say it. As president, I will protect all Americans from censorship by powerful tech corps." Incidentally, folks, I would not support Tulsi Gabbard, but I have to admit on this point, she does shine. I understand, though, that she's not quite as big a fan of the Second Amendment as she is of the First Amendment. And that is disappointing. But so we have a reparations queen who's been busted. Moving on here. This was a politician. John reported the story July 19th of this year, 2019. And we have a senator who didn't realize her family owned slaves, evidently. So, this is rather interesting. Senator Kamala Harris, Democrat from California. This article states, reparations for slavery have quickly become a hot-button political issue, with the House holding hearings on the topic last month and virtually all of the main Democratic candidates for president supporting the notion. As we reported in a recent edition of this paper, bills have been introduced in both the House and Senate to form a commission to study the concept of reparations for descendants of slaves. Democratic leaders, including House Speaker Nancy Pelosi of California, support the concept, as do most rank-and-file Democrats. Big surprise. The topic has even become an issue in the presidential debates, with Democrats vowing to pursue the matter in order to bring, quote-unquote, justice to the African-American community. Senator Kamala Harris, again, Democrat, California, a contender for the 2020 presidential nomination, has repeatedly voiced support for, quote, some type of reparations, unquote, for descendants of black slaves in America. Harris has condemned America's, quote, history of racism, unquote, and has argued that the government needs to, quote, give people a lift up, unquote. Interestingly, Harris herself may actually be a descendant of slave owners. In fact, she has not publicized or discussed this fact. An article written by her father and published by Jamaica Golobal reveals that Harris's roots can be traced back to Christina Brown, a descendant of Hamilton Brown. Hamilton Brown was a plantation and slave owner on the island of Jamaica. Well, I guess she wasn't expecting that. My roots go back within my lifetime to my parental grandmother, Miss Chrissy. That would be Nee Christiana Brown, a descendant of Hamilton Brown, who is on record a plantation and slave owner and founder of Brownstown. Her father wrote, according to media reports that in 1817, Hamilton Brown owned hundreds of slaves. Most of them were brought in from Africa, though he also owned many slaves who were brought in from other parts of the Caribbean. Harris has received criticism in the past, even from fellow Democrats and left-wing activists, by those who question the authenticity of her ties to the black community in America. She is, after all, a descendant of a Jamaican father and an Indian mother, both of whom were immigrants to America. Some of her critics argue that she lacks an authentic connection to the historical black experience in America, a criticism also leveled against Barack Obama when he was running for president. Kamala Harris doesn't have that connection to black Americans and the historical impact of slavery. In her lineage, Yvette Carnell, co-founder of the American Descendants of Slavery movement, argued earlier this year, following Harris's presidential bid announcement. She's anchored in two affluent immigrant parents. It's really simple. That hasn't stopped Harris from attempting to identify with the black community in America or its historical grievances, which are dishonestly fueled by the mass media, Hollywood, and the educational establishment. I'm black, and I'm proud of being black, Harris stated earlier this year following criticism expressed by those questioning her lineage. I was born black. I will die black. I'm not going to make excuses for anybody because they don't understand. Ironically, Harris may end up being among those responsible for paying reparations to descendants of slaves in America if the Democrats get their way. So, that's something to think about. And when you really think of who was responsible for the slave trade, well, it was, for the vast majority, it was a very, very concise tribe indeed. And on the by and large, it was not white people who ran this slave trade, who owned these slave ships, who profited from. And then when you look at the slave owners, both in the North and South, it does, to a very large degree, fall upon the Jewish people. Anyhow, we see how these things are politicized left and right, and true historical research, factual evidence, is often inconvenient to those pushing these agendas. We have a article from July 27th from Mr. Friend, who should be joining us in just a few minutes here. And again, if anyone does want to call in while John's on with us, you are welcome to do so. But the Holocaust, this article is entitled, "As a Tool to Flood America with Third Worlders." I have repeatedly argued that the fake Jewish, quote-unquote, Holocaust narrative of World War II is the linchpin of the entire New World Order system and white genocide agenda. Certain Jews have admitted as much. The Holocaust stands as Western civilization's greatest failure. Ian Kegden, former National Director of Government Relations of B'nai B'rith Canada, wrote in a 1991 Toronto Star op-ed piece titled "Memory of the Holocaust Central to New World Order." He continued, "It was a natural outcome of centuries of racism and of anti-Semitism. To deny the Holocaust is to deny racism's capacity to undercut our civilization's basic values and to destroy democracy, achieving our quest of a new world order depends on our learning of Holocaust's lessons. The false narrative of World War II more generally and the alleged quote-unquote Holocaust specifically has been used to strengthen Jewish identity and ethnocentrism while advancing Jewish and Zionist political and financial interests, both in the West and in the Jewish ethnostate of Israel. At the same time, the fake quote-unquote Holocaust narrative has been effectively used to psychologically disarm whites across the Western world. Anyone holding pro-white or quote-unquote racist perspectives, i.e. caring about white demographics, positively identifying with the culture, the history, and culture of whites, and in general, concerning oneself with the political interests of whites, etc., is immediately denounced as a neo-Nazi white supremacist bigot, just like Hitler and the evil Nazis. All right, looks like we just heard from our guest. He should be joining us in just a moment or two. It's all rather ridiculous, John goes on to state in this article, given the fact that non-whites, and especially Jews, are expected to identify with and celebrate their ethnic and racial background. Non-white groups in the U.S., again, especially Jews, form political lobbying groups and other political and economic organizations to champion and advance their perceived ethnic or racial interests. Whites, however, would never be allowed to engage in this type of ethnic activism and advocacy because, of course, the quote-unquote Holocaust. One of the key features of the New World Order system and white genocide agenda is massive non-white third world immigration to America and the wider Western world.
This call is being recorded.
Western countries across the world have allowed massive numbers of non-white third world people into their countries in the aftermath of World War II, largely and at the behest of the organized Jewish community who used the fake, quote-unquote, Holocaust narrative to justify their anti-white agenda. And this article goes on a little bit more, but it looks like we have a caller on the line. Hello.
Hey, Richard, this is John. Can you hear me?
Yes, John. I thought that would be you. Thank you for joining us. I was just catching up with the listeners on some of your recent articles I was reading. Definitely glad to have you here once again.
Yeah, thanks, man. It's good to catch up. I know it's been it's been over a year, I think, since the last time I was on. So thanks for having me back on. I appreciate it. It's always good to chat with you.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I remember the first time I finally got you on for an interview was when I was on Truthcat Radio. And then I remember the manager was he was being really biased to a guest he had lined up. I guess he found your content sensitive. But I noticed you published that far and wide to at least level the playing field. I like that. And then yeah, after that, after Truthcat, I was on Renegade, and, well, I know you already had come and left that platform. You were very good to them when you were there. I'll say that much. Perhaps nicer than they deserved, but they've done good things. I mean, I think Hellstorm is a great contribution that Kyle has contributed. I notice you still have it posted up on your site, and, yeah, I agree that, you know, we may disagree on little things here and there, but we appreciate all who contribute to our cause.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. You know, speaking of them, I actually listened to one of their more recent shows. I really don't listen to Renegade all that much anymore, but they were kind of going through and explaining their experience, like, you know, in the alternative media and like the history of Renegade and all the different people that they had on over the years. And I don't think they even mentioned me, which I thought was kind of surprising. I figured that they would bash me a little bit, but I don't think they really said much about me at all. I know Sinead made a comment, you know, a negative comment about me at the very end of one of the shows, but they didn't really get into it. And, you know, I mean, I had a good time broadcasting there. It was just one of those things that I didn't want to get bogged down in all the infighting, and I guess it's more than infighting. There's a lot of accusations being made that I don't think could really be substantiated. And, you know, I have no time for that sort of negative vibe, that constant negativity and, frankly, shit talking. I just, you know, I want nothing to do with that, you know, and it's a theme of, you know, internet, online, alternative media. You know, people just go online or on Twitter or any of these forums and comment sections. I mean, you name it. And people want to sit there all day long and just gossip and talk shit about other people and say this person is a Fed and this person's a shill and this person's a Jew and that person's compromised and this and that. It's just, I want nothing to do with any of that. It's a waste of time. It's a waste of energy. More importantly, it's very unproductive. It's a very unproductive way to spend your time if you really do care about the issues that you know, you and I care about, obviously, the issues that I cover on my website. I think these are very, very important and legitimate issues and topics to discuss openly. I think that's very important that we, you know, continue to do so. But when you're, you know, spending the majority of your time tearing down other people, criticizing other people, making baseless, not only baseless, but unsubstantiated allegations about people, it's just a waste of time, unproductive, and I just want nothing to do with it. So that's why I left Renegade. I wish them the best. I mean, I still think that I think both of them are in fact very talented. You know, they put together some great work over the years. They still do good radio shows, although I don't really follow their work all that closely anymore. Hellstorm, as you mentioned, was brilliant. And I know they've done a number of other documentaries, and you know, like I say, you know, they do good work, but I just, you know, I don't want anything to do with that negativity. But yeah. You see it, you know, it's unfortunate, and I'm not really online like I used to be. I'm not really involved posting and doing podcasts, certainly not like I used to. I mean, I barely have time to join you for a chat for an hour, you know, I let alone do a regular podcast or a regular live radio program, so I'm not nearly involved as I once was. I still, you know, try to follow the news and pay attention to what's going on. I still contribute to American Free Press, America's last real newspaper. And, you know, I am putting up articles on my blog every once in a while when I have when I have the time. But I'm just not involved like I used to be. So that being said, you know, given, you know, I'm not even involved as I once was, it makes my precious time on the internet even that much more precious, and I want to spend it doing something useful and productive. So
certainly, well, American Free Press is a great example of that. I've always thought at least you as an example of who they have there is a good recommendation of their content and writers. As far as this infighting, we'll see accusations thrown around. I totally relate to all that you say there. Even the callers to a lot of independent radio, you know, like a Patriot movement type radio shows, and that they'll just be getting so personal and at the throats of other callers. Everyone's all right or all wrong, and you know, has to be just attacking each other rather than the issues. And yeah, it can get very draining on one.
Yeah. Oh yeah, I agree. I mean, I try to just ignore it and you know, not even pay attention to it. Right. Although it's very difficult to not pay attention to it because you see it everywhere. But you know, yeah, that is what it is. You know, it's sort of the nature of the internet, I think. You know, especially when you're anonymous, and I've never been anonymous. I've always used, you know, my real name. I've never had a screen name or anything like that. I've always used my real name. So it's a lot different, I think, when you are, you know, representing yourself accurately and, you know, you sort of have a reputation to uphold and to protect and whatnot. You know, you kind of conduct yourself a little bit differently. But you know, I've always just tried to be as honest as possible because I mean, at the end of the day, if you can't even publicly say some of the things that we say, I mean, we really don't have free speech. And I know that's a topic we wanted to kind of address. And that's why I think it is so important. I mean, I don't think I would encourage people to go out there and, you know, talk about these issues using their real name. I don't think that is the smartest strategy to pursue. But I mean, if you're able to and if you're bold enough, I don't see anything wrong with it, but it's, you know, you got to be smart, I guess, is what I'm trying to say. And it depends on everybody's situation, you know, is sort of different. Mm-hmm. But again, at the end of the day, if no one is saying this stuff publicly, we may as well throw in the towel. You know, we really don't have free speech at that point.
Definitely. Definitely. I mean, a lot of people out there may want to be active, but they definitely have to watch out with some of these issues today, especially if they have children, or if they have a corporate job that their family income depends on. Yeah, that's unfortunately how it is. I, as well, have been using my real name. I mean, I used the name my grandfather had back in Poland when I was on Renegade, but prior to that on Truthcat and here on my own platform, you know, that's This is my legal name, just like yourself. I'm always curious about that, actually. So I'm appreciative that you clarified that for the listeners, because, I mean, friend is not that common a name. So a lot of people may have thought it was a pseudonym, but no, I definitely relate. And yeah, people out there definitely need to pick and choose if they're going to get into journalism themselves, depending on their lifestyle. And as I say, family can add to the concerns. I mean, they can take your family.
Absolutely, yeah.
They can take your family away for saying that you're, you know, a hate-filled white supremacist or something.
Yeah. I mean, there certainly are cases where that has happened, and what's even more common is people, you know, lose their job or maybe get kicked out of school or punished in some way like that. So there's a lot of factors that play into like the free speech issue that aren't even necessarily related to the government, because in America, we're not really seeing the government itself go after people for saying things publicly or posting things online. It's more private actors. It's, you know, these giant tech companies that have a monopoly on, on pretty much anything on the internet, where, you know, like these social media companies, for example, will blacklist people, and you'll be thrown off Twitter. You'll be thrown off Facebook, Instagram, et cetera. And then of course the, you know, the financial companies, the payment processors, PayPal. I was kicked off of PayPal years ago. Stripe is another fairly common, and increasingly more popular, alternative to PayPal. It basically, you know, basically works the same way. You know, I've been kicked off of Stripe. There's a number of other payment platforms that you know I'm basically banned from, Venmo, and even like the Bitcoin exchanges like Coinbase, for example. That's probably the most popular you know Bitcoin app that you can download and buy Bitcoin and trade Bitcoin and receive Bitcoin. You know, I've even been kicked off of that. So it's not really the government necessarily cracking down on this, although we are seeing the government do that in some cases. It's more these private actors. And then, of course, you know, like private corporations and employers, you know, they'll terminate you in a heartbeat if they catch wind that you're saying some of these things on the internet or in, you know, in real life for that matter. So it's a tricky situation, but I think, again, are the perspectives and the facts that I document and discuss on my website, the historical perspectives, the analysis of the media, and of reality in general, what the media portrays as reality to the American public and to the world public for that matter. I think that these are entirely legitimate and valid and accurate, you know, in a lot of cases, interpretations of what's really going on. And, you know, that's really the amazing thing about the internet is we kind of can at this point compete with the mainstream mass media and compete for, you know, control over the narrative, control over, you know, how people perceive the world and perceive our historical, situation, for example. And that's really kind of what that's always been my main focus, my main, I guess, goal with the website is to kind of explain to the world what I see is what's really going on, what the most important issues are, what, the topics that are most important and need to be addressed and openly discussed and understood by the American public if we're ever going to get out of this mess and prevent our country from becoming this completely tyrannical, unjust society, which is largely in place at this point. I mean, we're living in a very unjust, tyrannical society as it is. So
I had read a few of your articles to the listeners in the first hour here related to this topic. The one about the Jewish activist Deborah Lauter with the ADL, a former ADL staffer appointed head of Orwellian Office for the Prevention of Hate Crimes in New York City.
Right. I published that back in early September, so about a month ago, actually. And yeah, Deborah Loiter. I didn't really know a whole lot about her. I think, I mean, I was vaguely familiar with her. I'd like, you know, heard her name, but she was a longtime staffer at the ADL. And she's like basically this professional Jewish ethnic activist where she gets paid, and I'm sure she gets paid quite a lot of money, a lot more money than I'm making, I'm sure, to go out there and advocate on behalf of her people. And yet Jews like her would vehemently deny that very same right, that very same entirely legitimate, you know, thing to do if a white person were doing it, right? I mean, it's like this huge double standard. And that's what's amazing about reading the explicitly Jewish press, which is kind of a main theme of my website. I have a section called News from the Jews, where I've written a number of blog posts over the years in this section, including some on my old blog, where I'm just kind of highlighting and excerpting articles appearing in the explicitly Jewish press, newspapers like the Times of Israel or the Jewish Telegraph Agency or the Allgemeiner or the Jerusalem Post or Haaretz. There's a number of, you know, explicitly Jewish news outlets that are written by Jews, you know, for a Jewish audience. And it's really, really amazing some of the things that you'll learn and some of the things that you'll read in these publications like this. And it just shows you how powerful the organized Jewish community, how much privilege they truly have. Just the fact that I don't even know. It'd be interesting to come up with a list and like write, you know, a detailed article, you know, highlighting and showing all the various explicitly Jewish organizations operating in America. And then think about how many, you know, white organizations are operating in America, formulating and discussing, you know, issues relating to whites and our demographic situation going forward in America, our history, our culture, our economic prospects, our education. You know, this isn't even allowed in American society, although Jews have literally dozens, probably over 100. I mean, I don't know the exact number, but there's a number of very prominent ones that have, you know, huge amount of influence in our society, like the Anti-Defamation League, for example, like the World Jewish Congress, like the Zionist Organization of America, and a number of other organizations like this. And, you know, again, these people are raking in millions of dollars, billions of dollars for that matter, a year. It's like this huge industry. And, you know, they pay professional activists to go out there and advance the interests of the Jewish community. And that primarily relates to combating, quote unquote, anti-Semitism and hate and, you know, advancing, the pro-Israel agenda in Washington, D.C., basically, you know, giving more money to the state of Israel, giving more military and financial and diplomatic support to the Jewish state of Israel. Providing cover and, you know, whitewashing their crimes, you know, committed in the region against the Palestinians, against the Syrians. I mean, they're like attacking Syria on a regular basis. They're attacking other countries in the region on a regular basis. And this is covered up by us and, you know, downplayed and even justified, you know, by our own government. It's really incredible. And, again, if you read, you know, explicitly Jewish news outlets, they'll, you know, report these facts and comment on them. And yet, if you were to point it out, you'd be, you know, denounced as an anti-Semite when they themselves are kind of, you know, pointing a lot of this stuff out. But, you know, of course, they do so in a positive way. It's like a good thing, you know, for this professional Jewish ethnic activist to be named. She's like the head of the Office for the Prevention of Hate Crimes in New York City, especially created office at the behest of the organized Jewish community, at the behest of, or I'm sure after, you know, Jewish lobbying of the mayor to kind of create this office. And she's going to get paid a huge salary, no doubt. She's going to have a staff. She's going to have a budget. She's going to be working with, of course, law enforcement officials in New York City and other agencies and organizations in the city to combat quote unquote hate and to combat quote unquote anti-Semitism, which essentially amounts to any criticism of Jews, any statement of basic facts about Jewish power and influence and their agenda and the sort of policies that they promote, the sort of anti-white hatred and bigotry on display, you know, coming directly from their mouths, the sort of anti-white policies that they promote, you know, including open borders, including, you know, again, unlimited and unconditional aid and support for the Jewish state of Israel, you know, advancing all these, you know, totally counterproductive and un-American agendas in the Middle East. All these wars that we're fighting in the Middle East are basically to advance Israel's geopolitical interests in the region. So we see this all the time on a daily basis, you know, and yet nobody wants to point it out.
And then
at least nobody in the mainstream, nobody in the establishment, I should say, because there are a lot of people pointing this stuff out now, an increasing number, which is very good and a very positive development. But, you know, nobody in the mainstream, nobody in either of the, you know, more establishment political parties are talking about any of these issues. And it's sad. I mean, really, because they are legitimate and important topics to discuss. You know, for example, Ann Coulter, I remember Ann Coulter caused this huge controversy back in, I think it was during the 2016 election, you know, leading up to it, when she made some tweets. I actually wrote about it. I could probably find it on my website. She made a tweet about, you know, how many effing Jews are in America, because like all the Republicans were talking about were how much, you know, they love Israel, and, you know, they were just going on and on about Israel during these debates. And, you know, she made this tweet, and it was this huge controversy, right? Simply for her mentioning this and bringing this up, you know, and she didn't even do so really in a very critical manner, really point anything out. She was just kind of making fun of them. Like, look, how many, you think that the whole world revolves around Jews in Israel? And many of these people do think that. That's certainly the way they act. That's certainly, you know, who's funding their campaigns and they're advancing these Jewish interests and this Jewish agenda first and foremost above anything else. And, you know, her pointing this out, here's one article I put up. This is back in September of 2015. You know, there was this big outrage and all this concern about Ann Coulter making these comments because it was mainstreaming anti-Semitism. And that's another, you know, sort of criticism that the organized Jewish community has had about President Trump. You know, he's mainstreaming hate and racism for even bringing up some of these more politically incorrect topics, like illegal immigration, for example.
We shouldn't be allowed to even talk about them. They should be that taboo, right?
No, exactly. Well, yeah, and that's the way it's been for decades. I mean, really, since World War II, which, you know, following World War II, I mean, we saw the Jews totally take over American society. I mean, it had been going on, you know, the Jewish subversion of America and, you know, infiltration and sort of takeover of American society, the American government.
And I mentioned Patriot yeah. Radio. It's amazing. I'll hear out there how many people aren't aware of the atrocities of Stalin's regime, you know, Stalin's communist regime. They have this absurd view of World War II and world history, which is completely shaped around the Jewish agenda.
Absolutely, yeah, it's so true, and it's a point that I make all the time, you know, and almost pretty much any blog post I'm making, any radio program I'm participating in. I mean, this is got to be understood, and it's so easy to demonstrate it. I mean, you know, Jews themselves, major Jewish leaders, major figures, you know, these like professional Jewish activists, you know, leading these organizations, they will openly say these things, openly talk about how, you know, the New World Order is based on the lessons of the Holocaust and, you know, what happened during World War II. You know, there's literally every single day there's articles coming from the Jewish press, and even, you know, you'll even see them in the mainstream mass media talking about rising levels of anti-Semitism and hate crimes. And, you know, it basically all amounts to more and more people discovering these facts that we've been talking about for years, these perspectives that we've been discussing and writing about for years. And not only us, I mean, you know, there's a long history of people doing this sort of stuff. So it's good. I mean, I think, you know, I think it's good that there are more and more people kind of learning about these things and bringing them up and talking about them and confronting people. I don't know if you've been following what's been going on with that Turning Points USA organization and like the tour that they're doing at these various on these various college campuses around the country. But you know, people are getting up and asking them tough questions, bringing up very legitimate, totally legitimate, totally valid, yet controversial topics like the USS Liberty, for example. One guy was even talking about the dancing Israelis on 9/11. He kind of made a joke about it. I'm not sure if you saw the clip or not, but this is all very, very good. This is exactly what needs to be done. I mean, these people need to be confronted, and it takes courage. It takes people to get up there and say these things and not back down. And, you know, really that's the most important thing that we could be doing, I think, at this point is not backing down and getting our ideas out there and challenging these people in a big way. And again, you got to be smart about it. But I think that is really what needs to happen. And it's causing a lot of attention. It's causing a lot of controversy. And again, it's bringing more and more people, at least aware of these issues. I mean, I think that was the big theme of the 2016 election was Trump wasn't necessarily like this, you know, the media portrayed him as like Hitler and like a neo-Nazi and a white supremacist. You'll still see people calling Trump a white supremacist. It's absurd. But I think it's true that the Overton window, in our political discourse has, you know, been pushed in our direction, right? And when I say our, I mean, you know, a more truthful, honest, pro-white, critical, you know, people that can think critically about what the media and government and their, you know, their teachers are telling them about World War II, for example, and other topics.
Right. I mean,
it's pushed things in our direction.
Right. Even on that note, the media's portrayal of Trump as Hitler-like, that, keep in mind, is, of course, the official Allied history book writing and Hollywood depiction, really, of what Hitler was rather than what he really was, for that matter.
Absolutely.
It's
the Jewish perspective of Hitler.
Right.
It's the Jewish perspective of World War II.
And all
which
these
has
topics.
Been and all these topics, basically.
I mean, I read that story of the senator who turned out to have family owning a Jamaican plantation of slaves. A Kamala Harris who's talking about reparations politically, just the hypocrisy with that. And of course, I read the story of the hate crime hoaxes, with a couple of great examples there. I thought you were going to, when you mentioned 95 or 2015, I thought you were going to quote that that article you wrote on America's racial powder keg, because I thought it was very powerful. Israel Cohen, a radical Marxist Jew, you quote, admitting in 1912 here, just how racial tensions are a weapon for them. We must realize that our party's most powerful weapon is racial tensions. By propounding into the consciousness of the dark races that for centuries they have been oppressed by whites, we can mold them to the program of the Communist Party. In America, we will aim for subtle victory while inflaming the Negro minority against the whites. We will endeavor to instill in the whites a guilt complex for their exploitation of the Negroes. We will aid the Negroes to rise in prominence in every walk of life, in the professions, and in the world of sports and entertainment. With this prestige, the Negro will be able to intermarry with the whites and begin a process which will deliver America to our cause. And this is written in 1912 by Israel Cohen. We're seeing all that come to fruition today. And of course, communism being a vehicle of these people all along as well. But I'm sorry to interrupt so much there earlier.
No, you're fine. Yeah, that quote is, I remember first reading that quote years ago, and it's, I think the source, it's always kind of hard to track down the source, but if I'm not mistaken, it was read into the congressional record way back when, back in like the early 1900s. I can't remember exactly all the details off the top of my head. So, you know, there have been some people that have questioned the legitimacy or the validity of the quote, but you got to admit that everything that is explained in that sort of disputed quote is exactly what we see playing out today. It's something we've been seeing play out all throughout, you know, the 1950s and 1960s. See, and that's the thing. I mean, it's so incredible. You know, there was a speaking of going back to this Turning Points USA, the TPUSA college tour, and these people getting up and asking very pointed and controversial questions. One of the comments that I think the guy's name is Matt Walsh, if I'm not mistaken. I think he works for Ben Shapiro. And, you know, he's like this basically conservative ink type guy, you know, that loves Israel. He's critical of the wars and in American foreign policy, but, you know, he loves Israel. And he's not really saying anything too controversial, certainly nothing from like our perspective. And somebody was asking him, I can't remember exactly all the details, but basically he was saying, oh, well, are you guys just going to bring up the Jews all the time? Like, it's so childish the way it's even presented, because, well, yeah, I'm going to bring up the Jews because we can prove that they're behind all this stuff. And, you know, they themselves will openly admit it and talk about their own agenda and what they're up to and how much they hate white people and how much, you know, white countries need to be destroyed for, you know, the quote-unquote crimes of the Holocaust and how white people have always been oppressive and anti-Semitic. So that's the thing. I mean, it really does, and I hate to be the one to have to tell people this, but it's so true and it's so critical for understanding how the world actually works. You have to talk about the Jewish question. You have to understand the Jewish problem. And it's something that, you know, has been occurring all throughout history. And in the past, people did talk about it and people did recognize it. And Jews were basically isolated and sort of kept in check. But that's all changed, certainly in America and certainly since World War II. Where they are dictating to us what our foreign policy is going to be, for example. They're the ones controlling Hollywood and pumping out all this propaganda and all this degeneracy and all this programming and really, you know, controlling the discourse, controlling the narrative, controlling the perspective that people have. And, you know, that's really what this is all about. And if you don't understand that, then you're missing what's really going on and what the real problems are. You know, we could talk about any number of subjects, immigration, you know, how America has been totally transformed from basically a white nation. And it was always thought of as like an extension of Western civilization. It was this, you know, white Protestant, you know, Anglo-Saxon founded country. You know, it was sort of a country for, you know, people from Europe essentially escaping persecution and wanting to create a better life and to have opportunities. And that's really the history of America, the way it's been thought of. But that idea has been totally transformed by these radical anti-white Jewish intellectuals and Jewish activists to where now America is this proposition nation where anybody can just come over here and become an American citizen. You know, and even like these mainstream conservative figures, they'll say America is, it's not really a nation, it's an idea. You know, there's no such thing as like authentic Americans. Well, that's a bunch of nonsense. I mean, you know, people that are born and bred here, that have a connection to the land, a connection to the nation, a connection to the history, those are real Americans, not somebody that just jumped the border and set up, you know, went to their local welfare office and got on the dole. You know, these people aren't Americans, and yet that's the narrative that, you know, the organized Jewish community and the people that go along with that, which is basically everybody in the mainstream, that's the narrative that they promote. And, you know, you see the devastating consequences that it's had, and it's only a matter of time before more and more people wake up to this, because it's certainly no secret anymore. I mean, this you just got to take a walk around in any mid-sized city or major city in America to see how it's becoming increasingly more and more diverse, increasingly more and more chaotic, increasingly more and more anti-white, where whites are just being openly attacked and demonized in the media and demonized in Hollywood and demonized even in our school system, you know? It's very difficult. You have to be, willfully ignorant, willfully blind to not recognize what's going on at this point. It's just a matter of connecting the dots. And, that's really my main goal, my main mission is to help people connect the dots, to point out these very controversial and taboo subjects and facts and perspectives.
I find it important to keep going back to the Jews as well. And like you say, I've heard critics out there who try to act like that is just one more conspiracy theory, like it's all one group doing things that's crazy, no matter what group you're pinning it as. And they're saying, oh, that's like saying it's the, it's the Masons or that it's the Vatican or, the Illuminati or something. But I mean, people don't seem to want to look into the true history of it. They're afraid that labels them, and there's that buzzword again, anti-Semite. And that's really a lot of where the power, I think, lies, is how much fear they're trying to perpetuate for people to not want to be called that.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think that is a key factor in how they wield control so successfully is, the weaponization of language, the weaponization of our political discourse, the control of our political discourse, and the control of our historical narratives, right? I mean, that's really where their power comes from. It's not like they're physically enslaving us. They have us psychologically psychologically and emotionally even enslaved to their agenda, to where, again, talking about free speech, there's articles now, coming out in mainstream publications. The Washington Post, for instance, just published an article. It wasn't, I don't think the guy is Jewish himself, but this is something that, the organized Jewish community has been pushing for a very long time, and they've been very successful in basically all over Europe. They want to shut down any sort of, criticism of their agenda, any disagreement or, even like scholarly inquiries into their sacred narratives relating to World War II and relating to the Holocaust. That's how they've been so successful, is they've controlled the discourse, controlled the narrative, and they've used these weaponized buzzwords to delegitimize their political opponents and to delegitimize and smear and slander anybody that's, trying to tell the truth about what's really going on and present, an alternative perspective.
Well, one article I was reading, one other article I read to the listeners earlier was very refreshing to me, by the Malaysian Prime Minister Mahathir Mohamad. I thought that was just brilliant.
Yeah, no, he's good. I've been following him for a number of years. He was actually pretty close, from what I understand, he was pretty close with Michael Collins Piper, who was a longtime journalist for American Free Press. He also contributed to the Barnes Review. And, he's an author of a number of books, including one of the most important books about the JFK assassination called Final Judgment, which really ties in the Israeli angle to the entire conspiracy, which is a very interesting and well-documented and thoroughly put together book. If you haven't, not you necessarily, but the audience in general, if you're not familiar with that book, I'd highly recommend it. It's what he's probably most well known for. But anyways, he was pretty close with President Mahathir Mohamad, and he's been speaking his mind and telling the truth about the organized Jewish community for a number of years, and every time it sparks this huge backlash. And that was the case. Let me see if I can find that article. Actually, yeah, this was I published this at the end of September, September 29th, and the blog post is titled "Free Speech is Fundamentally Anti-Semitic," where he was questioned by a pretty obnoxious Jewish student at Columbia University. He was giving a speech, a presentation. He was participating in a forum, actually, where he was kind of being interviewed. It was actually the what is the name of the forum? The Global Leaders Forum, I think it's called. And somebody got up and asked him a question. This Jewish girl got up and asked him a question about, you know, what he thought about the Holocaust, if he's a Holocaust denier, this and that. And he basically said, look, you can't have free speech if you can't be anti-Semitic, if you can't say things that Jews don't like, you know, or wish to have banned. And that's absolutely true. You know, if we're too afraid to say these things, in America, if we're too afraid to say it, because we might get fired from our job or ostracized or attacked by Antifa or whatever, then we really don't have free speech. You know, certainly if we say these things and get arrested, you know, like you can in Europe, then obviously we don't have free speech. But if we can't say them free of, you know, the social and economic repercussions, then, you know, it's sort of pointless. You know, it shows that the spirit of the First Amendment has been totally eroded and undermined and destroyed. And, you know, that's sad to say, that's what's been going on in America for a long time. There are still people that, you know, are bold enough to get up and say these things, but it's few and far between.
Yes, it certainly is. And so we have like little inches along toward trying to whittle away at our First Amendment. And right now the center of it, it seems, is the BDS, right? It's mostly at corporations right now, though. Isn't it not actually being enforced against individuals?
Yeah, you know, I'm not an expert in this topic. You know, I do follow it and see stories about it from time to time. I know, I want to say I think it's the state of Florida, the state of Texas. You know, they have like state laws on the books where, you know, you won't be awarded, you know, a state contract if you participate in the boycott, divestment, sanctions effort against Israel. But I, you know, I don't know all of the details, but yeah, I mean, that's a good example of, you know, an outright attack on the First Amendment, outright attack on your ability to, you know, take a stance on a political issue, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely. And I was noticing you had an article pointing out Facebook donating quite a large sum to the ADL, $2.5 million. That just reminds people just how much they're committed to the Jewish agenda.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's like every single day you know, I scroll through the headlines and, you know, it's one Jewish organization, you know, telling the president what to do about Israel. You know, the next day it's the ADL testifying in front of Congress about the rising threat of, you know, white supremacist terrorism and the rising tide of anti-Semitism. You know, the next day it's the Jewish CEO of Facebook donating millions of dollars to the ADL, a professional Jewish ethnic activist organization, you know, openly seeking to shut down people that criticize Jews. You know, it's just like the Jewish privilege in American society could not be more obvious. You know, it's just astounding. And yet, you know, you say these things, you point these things out, and you're, you know, treated as like this pariah, this hateful bigot that just doesn't like Jews. You have this irrational, blind hatred for Jews. And, you know, frankly, it's not even like, you know, me personally, it's not like I even hate Jews. It's just, you know, we got to be serious about this. We got to be able to point out these facts and talk about their subversive and, you know, anti-American, anti-white agenda. And it's very tyrannical. You know, we've been discussing it. They've been, you know, promoting, you know, massive non-white immigration into America. They're behind the censorship and the shutdown of, you know, people being able to say things critical of them on the internet. And I mean, we could go on and on and on. And, you know, it's just it really is astounding, like the total Jewish tyranny that we live under. And, you know, it's easy to notice once you sort of see it. It's like, wow, how could I be so blind to this for so long, you know, especially again now where it's becoming increasingly more and more apparent as each day passes, it seems like.
Yes, well, but the younger generations are continually being brought up to be taught about white guilt, and they're taught about these perceptions of some speech as being hate speech. You know, that's another very damaging thing, is just this idea, another buzzword, hate speech, that some speech shouldn't be included in free speech.
Yeah, that's very dangerous when, you know, we're getting into very dangerous territory when, you know, more and more Americans, and you know, I actually have a couple, like public opinion surveys about this topic, and it seems to kind of just vary depending on the person putting out the survey, but, you know, you could probably go around and ask people in public and get a good gauge of it, or just like ask, you know, people you know.
Well, I found a very disturbing. I found a very disturbing article in the Washington Post from October 29th entitled "Why America Needs a Hate Speech Law."
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's the article that I was mentioning earlier, and I think the guy, I actually had the article pulled up, but I have an ad blocker on, so I couldn't actually read the article, and I didn't want to kind of mess with it during the show here. But I mean, I read the article when it first came out, and I think he's a former State Department official, if I'm not mistaken. I think under President Obama, and yeah, he's basically just openly calling for, you know, the restriction of the First Amendment, essentially. Which to me, I mean, think about it. This is like the bedrock of American society. It's one of the most important political traditions, I think, that we have in our country, and it's being directly assaulted by the establishment, by these, you know, giant tech companies, and even to a certain extent by the government itself. And yeah, it's very troubling. It's very worrying. And you know, getting back to, you know, whether or not people think that, you know, hate speech should be allowed, I think it really just kind of depends on the way the question is framed. And you know, a lot, it's sad, you know, a lot of people are just very, very ignorant on political issues and these sorts of things. They just don't really think about them too much. So that I don't really, to me, it's not so much of what like an average person thinks about it. It's what the elite are saying about it, and what the government and like the media are saying about it, the way they're framing it. And, you know, they've been pushing, you know, censorship and you know, ending anti-Semitism for decades now. And, you know, especially now with so many people sort of waking up and getting on board and recognizing what's going on, they'd certainly love to be able to throw anybody off the internet and get them fired and doxxed and everything else for saying some of these things and bringing up these facts. And, you know, that's exactly what we've been seeing take place here in this country for a long time.
And Europe, they're farther along considerably in most European countries from what I've been hearing. So it's unfortunate if we see with a push toward globalism, if that continues to succeed, it would be disturbing if, you know, people were urged in America to take a cue from the European countries and the UN, almost the same way they are with this climate change, whatever their agenda is, if that's a distraction or what, or related to the economy and poor growing seasons. But regardless, I mean, it seems like there could be a strong push to be like Europe, and you have to accept hate speech. It's the way of the future, you know. It's the way toward that Star Trek future.
Yeah, and it's always this one-way street. It's always, you know, hate speech. And if you're critical of minorities, especially Jews, or if you, you know, point out basic facts about minorities, point out, you know, the outrageous black-on-white crime, or, you know, Jewish power and influence in American society and their, you know, overall agenda, this is considered hate speech. Yet, you know, Jews and other minorities, and even white people for that matter, can get up and you know, bash white people all day long, attack white people physically all day long, and basically face no repercussions. It's a very one-sided you know, situation where whites are targeted and minorities, especially Jews, are elevated and protected. And that's, of course, the way it's designed.
Yes, and we've had, as you mentioned, so much, even with the Trump supporters, that's been ramped up and exaggerated. You had an interesting article I didn't get to, but a myth of white terror debunked. And you refer to both SPLC and ADL, Southern Poverty Law Center, and the Anti-Defamation League, and a lot of these alleged threats of white supremacists, right?
Yeah, exactly. It's been this theme that's been, you know, running throughout the media for a very long time, but it really increased following the alleged shooting in El Paso, Texas. When was that? Maybe 2 months ago. I can't even remember off the top of my head. It was sort of recently, and you know, a lot of these shootings, these big traumatic events that are used to promote all of these tyrannical anti-white agendas, I really do question the media's narrative, the media's explanation of how they happened. And you know, I frankly, I don't know if anything like that really did happen. You know, I don't know exactly. I have no idea what happened, but I question the validity of the mainstream narrative. And this goes even back to the alleged shooting in Charleston, South Carolina, you know, Dylan Stormroof, that whole alleged shooting. Mm-hmm. That was incredibly bizarre, very suspicious, as all of these mass shootings are. And you see it, and I've made this point before, and I remember writing an article about it shortly after the alleged Charleston shooting back in, I think that was 2015. You know, immediately after that, op-ed, you know, leading op-ed in the New York Times by the the leaders of the Southern Poverty Law Center, they've both since either been fired or have resigned. Morris Deeds and Richard Cohen, I think was his name. You know, they have this op-ed published in the New York Times immediately afterwards, talking about how the government and even the military, for that matter, need to view, you know, quote unquote, white supremacist terrorism as the next targets in this broader global war on terrorism. So this idea was, you know, they were advancing this idea going back then and probably even before, for that matter. But I remember it really kind of being promoted then in the immediate aftermath of the alleged shooting in Charleston. And then we really saw it, you know, step up a notch following the alleged shooting in El Paso, Texas, another very bizarre, suspicious and, you know, dubious event, I should point out. And in fact, you even had they even made a hashtag white supremacist terrorism shortly after this alleged shooting. I don't know if you caught that or if you pay attention much to Twitter and social media and stuff, but yeah, I mean, there was this hashtag, everybody was talking about it, everybody in the mainstream media, even a lot of, like, quote-unquote conservatives, these, like, fake phony establishment conservatives were talking about it. So yeah, I mean, it kind of shows you their agenda and how they use these events, whether they're real or whether they're, you know, manufactured and created by the mass media, which is, you know, kind of what I lean towards. But I don't know. I don't say that for sure. That's sort of my speculation. You know, we certainly see how these events are being used to promote this agenda, to promote this narrative. And now we're at a point where, you know, again, I mentioned, you know, groups like the ADL and the SPLC, they're like testifying in front of Congress as expert witnesses, you know, as experts in this field. And they, you know, they always have been, but especially now in the wake of all this. And they're saying, look, the FBI needs to treat white supremacist terrorists, you know, who engage in hate speech, who engage in, you know, and, you know, who you know, promote anti-Semitic conspiracy theories and stuff like that, they need to be viewed as the primary target in this broader global war on terrorism. And that's basically what the FBI adopted. And then that's kind of what that article gets into. I've been covering that issue a lot for American Free Press recently and you know, even over the years. And it's very important, and it's very easy to see, you know, the agenda behind it and how they use these events to promote it. And just the dubious nature of all of these alleged events.
I definitely have seen a lot of coverage by journalists and independent media poking a lot of holes in a good number of these shooting incidents. And I agree with you. I mean, it's a case-by-case basis, but I definitely see a lot of evidence that quite a lot of them seem like they have been, people can get confused. Sometimes people die, sometimes people don't, but definitely groomed by three-letter agencies and staged to varying degrees is what we're seeing evident in a lot of these incidents.
Yeah, exactly. Including the most recent one, there was, I actually just tweeted about it. There was a guy, I think in Colorado. He was entrapped basically by the FBI. You know, they had kind of infiltrated his online chat room, you know, the different forums he was visiting online. And, let's see, I have a direct quote actually. The guy's name was Richard Halzer, and he was brought into custody at a motel on Friday night, so last Friday, shortly after he examined inert explosive devices presented to him by undercover agents. So undercover agents actually provided this guy with the fake bombs that he was going to use to attack and you know, attempt to blow up this synagogue in Colorado. And, you know, it's interesting because we see this happening now. This seems to be happening a lot with all of these alleged, you know, white supremacist terrorists. They're always somehow being entrapped or encouraged or facilitated by undercover agents. And this is the same exact thing that we saw with all these alleged Islamic terrorists, you know, going back even prior to 9/11. And you know, this was actually something I remember first reading about, really, even before I was researching 9/11. There was the first attempt on the World Trade Center, I think it was in 93, and the blind sheikh behind it was basically being coached and facilitated by undercover FBI agents. So they're like setting this stuff up and helping facilitate it happen in order to kind of crack down on it and to, you know, justify this broader agenda. So we're seeing the same exact thing play out today. Just this time it's with, you know, quote unquote, white supremacist terrorists.
Well, you mentioned how
amazing times we live in.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you mentioned how it's at a point where we just need to saturate, the independent media with this information that it's taboo to talk about. And really, I would say that Daniel Freiberg has a good quote where he mentions we have to win the war of ideas. And I like that because that's really where we're at. You know, you have to remind people we're not trying to encourage a violent sort of response to anything. And that's exactly what a lot of this is portrayed as by those who are trying to perpetuate all these agendas. But we just have to stay diligent and keep informing people. And eventually I think that war of ideas can turn in our favor. But there's a slow crawl between Zionism and communism that these people are achieving across our nation. And we definitely have to put a halt to it. Thank you so much. I see we're out of time, but I'd love to do this again and keep in touch regularly, John.
All right, man. Thank you so much. Sounds good.
All right. Cheers. Have a great night.
Okay, you too.
And thank you to all the listeners, and we will speak again soon. Until then, transcend the construct. Regards.